Hi, I'm Issa Kwonga.
And I'm Ryan Hun.
And we co-host Stadio, a football podcast, on the Ringer Podcast Network.
If you like soccer or football, make sure you search for Stadio, a football podcast, on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real-life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower What's Next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client. This episode is brought to you by Max. The new HBO original limited series, The Sympathizer, is an espionage thriller and cross-culture satire that follows a communist spy during the final days of the Vietnam War and his new life as a refugee in Los Angeles. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr. and based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Sympathizer is streaming now exclusively on Max. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more.
It is Thursday, June 1st. As this writer's strike enters its second month, it sometimes feels like the Guild has 12,000 spokespeople, all posting on social media and talking to whatever outlets will listen, including this one. We've heard a lot less of the studio and streamer's position on this labor impasse. That's strategic. The top studio negotiator, Carol Lombardini, has instructed her members not to argue their case in the media. And whenever the top executives are asked about the strike at events, they usually say they support the writers, they hope they can make a deal, and by the way, we have plenty of great content to ride out this strike. But as I mentioned when I had the Guild leaders on the show, these issues aren't easy, and I am interested in the studio perspective on these talks. Thankfully, Gail Berman agreed to come on the show. Gail is a successful producer now, co-owns her company, The Jackal Group, and has been an EP on recently the Elvis movie and Wednesday on Netflix. But she formerly ran both a film studio and a television network, the only woman to accomplish that feat, actually. In 2000, she was named president of entertainment at Fox Broadcasting and ran that network during an era when it launched 24, American Idol, My Favorite, The OC, tons more. Then she left TV and became president of Paramount Pictures for nearly 2 years. Gail's got a great view of the chaos and anxiety that has come to dominate Hollywood these days and the issues that led to this strike. She's actually not as gracious towards these companies as one might think, which begs the question, who is? So today, it's why the studios won't just pay the writers and a side of the strike you may not have considered. From The Ringer and Puck, I'm Matt Bellany, and this is The Town. All right, we are here with Gail Berman, who, in addition to being a successful producer, you are one of the rare people in this business who has run a television network in addition to a film studio. So you are uniquely position for today's topic. Welcome, first of all.
Thank you so much. Nice being here.
We are at the Media in Montauk convention conference in beautiful Montauk. We're looking out at the ocean right now. So
it's a great day.
It is a nice day. We're in a good mood. So tell me what you think the industry that this strike is happening in. This was supposed to all be dealt with in 2020. When the business was in a very different place and these companies were sort of riding high on this peak TV, then the pandemic hit and they punted these issues for 3 years. Do you think if these issues had been debated and negotiated in 2020, that there would have been a strike?
I don't.
You don't think there would have been? I don't either.
I think that there was an opportunity then because clearer heads were prevailing, I think.
People were doing well.
They were feeling good about where things were. Nobody felt like the air was going to get pricked out of it.
And it would have been a fight over money. And fights over money tend to get resolved.
Yeah. There are always fights about money. Let's face it. Every negotiation that goes on in Hollywood is a fight about money. But this is much more profound than that. This is really the future of the creative part of the industry. And how can young people sustain themselves in the long run? And I had the good fortune of having a definition of back end. And I'd like to see that for young creators. I mean, you don't want to see diminishing returns here. You'd like to see the next generation do as well or even better than your generation. And that's not happening.
I agree. But what I'd like to talk about with you is the other side, the studio position, because you've been in that chair. And it's easy to say, just pay the writers. But it's not that easy, especially in this climate. And the argument that these studios and streamers make is that while that business was great for someone like you, who came up in the 90s and the 2000s and was part of a television business that really doesn't exist these days, we have to make new models and we have to evolve. And these writers don't seem to be willing to evolve.
I don't see it that way at all. I understand from a studio perspective, the dogmatic approach that they don't see it at all. They see it. They're grown-up people too. They're worried. They really have a good reason to be worried. And I have looked at strikes in the past and said, really, you're going to strike about this?
Mm-hmm.
I have. My husband being on the picket line while
right.
I was...
Your husband is a television writer, right. Yes.
While I was coming in at 5 o'clock in the morning, so I didn't cross the picket
line. Right.
But the issues here are really profound. There are educated people on both sides of this equation. And while it seems that there's one or two or three issues that come up on a strike banner, the fact is that the fundamentals here are affecting everybody. Affects non-writing executive producers. It's affecting writers. It's affecting directors. And it's going to affect the talent.
And these are the issues we've talked about many times on this show, the mini rooms where fewer writers are required, the different profit and residual definitions for streaming than for linear television. A lot of these more existential questions of whether the studios want to use AI to replace writers, all of that. Why then don't the studios make concessions here?
Well, I think they're going to make concessions ultimately. But I also think if I put my studio hat on mm-hmm. for a moment, they don't know where all of this is headed either. They're nervous about that. Let's say you do agree to something about AI, and then all of a sudden AI is something else. Earlier this week, we found out AI was going to destroy the entire planet.
Right, extinction level,
So it went from, oh yeah, it'll be a good development tool, to it's going to make us an extinct population. So nobody knows where this all is headed. And so there's a bit of posturing, not a bit, there's a lot of posturing going on that side saying, hey, you can't tie our hands. And that's understandable too, because technology is moving forward and we can't pretend that it's not. We have to make caveats for the improvements here. And I'm looking at them as improvements because I think that ultimately technology is a good thing. But
it's not preventable.
It comes at a cost. And let me tell you, the cost of doing 6 episodes after working for 5 years and getting 6 episodes, it's tough to justify the ROI on that.
Yeah.
It is for me.
Yeah, and you're a non-writing producer.
And I'm a non-writing producer. It's tough for me.
Right.
It's tough for a writer, too.
Yeah, you work on a project, maybe do free work, maybe do 5 drafts. Then you get that coveted green light, and it's 6 episodes, and you're paid as if it's 6 episodes of a 24-episode series, but it's not.
But it's not.
Yeah.
So I come from a universe where 22 episodes is the norm when you're successful. And I want to put the success quotient into this conversation, because a lot of what's going on and the talk about what's going on is, hey, everybody achieved the brass ring before. That is not true. No one ever had their show removed from circulation. That is not
true.
That
is definitely not true.
I made more of those phone calls in my career than I care to talk about.
Yeah, your show is canceled after 4 episodes.
4 episodes.
And it will never be shown anywhere.
It can be canceled after 1 episode.
And even when the others are in the can.
That is correct. So, I mean, the idea that that's somehow a new thing or absolutely unacceptable.
Yeah. We're talking about Disney removing shows from Hulu and Disney Plus. Warner has done the same on HBO Max. Yeah, there's a lot of uproar about that, but it's really nothing new. It's just that we have been taught over the past 5 to 10 years to expect that everything will always be available to us at any time, whenever we want.
That is correct. I have to say that those people who are crying over this, that's a mistake. It should not be, in my mind, a part of this conversation. This has happened since the first days of television. If it's not happening, your show gets removed.
What about the success metric? because that's a key thing in this negotiation that shows that our hits should be treated as hits like they once were. You are an EP on Wednesday, the Netflix series, which is a objectively, everybody knows it, a big hit. And yet the creators of that show and the producers are not rewarded more than they would be if it's a regular
Well,
Netflix
I think
show.
This is a really important point, Matt. And I actually do think that this is at the heart of everything, which is that success should bear success for the people involved. And I think when it doesn't, it creates really bad feelings. And you don't get super hits all the time. I've had a few of them in my career, and I've been fortunate enough to have that. And I'd like to see the next generation be fortunate enough to have, you know, I have a house up the road here, and it's called Malcolm's Landing. And I like to tell everybody it's called Malcolm's Landing for a reason, because Malcolm paid for it.
Patty Felker, the lawyer, likes to talk about her house as the house that Phil built, because right. her client, Phil Rosenthal, created Everybody Loves Raymond, and that bought her that house.
It's not to pat myself on the back to say, oh, look what I have. It's much more about saying the new generation, the people who are working today, should have the same opportunity that I had and be able to create a success metric for themselves where they too can have something that benefits their success and their and is a part of their family's success as well. So it's really, really important for studio executives and the AMPTP to recognize that we have to come up with a success model.
But put your studio hat on for a second, and why don't they do that? It opens up a big Pandora's box of data.
It certainly does, and tech companies don't like sharing data. They love data. Everyone loves data. They talk about data like it's nonstop. They don't like to share it. But let me be clear about this. This is nothing new about this either. And what I mean by that is, yes, Nielsen told us when a show was successful, often not exactly accurate, but told us this is a success.
It was universally accepted.
Yes, it was a there was a universal acceptance to Nielsen numbers. But this situation is different than that. You have to know that if you were the person who won the brass ring, the studios weren't so forthcoming with you.
Yeah, you'd have to audit.
Everyone had to audit.
Yeah.
Sometimes more sue, than one time.
Or sue.
Two, three times. Yeah. And then sometimes people had to sue. And, you know, I remember the Bones case very well because I picked up Bones. So
there was litigation from the creators of Bones against Fox because the argument was that they had licensed the show essentially to itself via Hulu, which was controlled by Fox and now Disney. And they shortchanged the creators millions of dollars.
Yes. And they also shortchanged them in the international markets. And what people didn't realize was that the international department of Fox was bringing David Boreanaz to Germany and various other countries around the world because the show was so successful. And he was coming out and introducing the show and shaking hands with people, et cetera, et cetera. And then all of a sudden he was told, well, there is no value to that. So when I say to you that there's nothing new about it, it's a different language, same problem.
Yeah. Studios are bad actors too sometimes.
From
but
time
that gets
to time.
To the argument. I've talked to an agent who I trust on this subject, and this agent was saying to me, be careful what you wish for. You want a success metric? You'll start to learn that a lot of these shows don't have any audience. And if you want the upside, you're going to have to take the downside. And at least these streamers are paying above market on the initial payments, and you capture that and you don't have to take the risk of nobody watching.
I think that that's a really great point. And we have to understand that there are both sides of the coin, as there have always been in the industry. There's really nothing terribly new about these arguments because they've been had before, but with a different technological bent. But also the opportunities to create a real life for yourself with 22 episodes, if you were lucky enough to get that, or staff for 22. This notion of mini rooms is really just, it's just kicking the can down the road.
This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real-life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower What's Next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
I want to talk a little bit about the money issue, because you see a lot of these facts that I put air quotes around that the Writers Guild has been putting out about what it would cost these companies to resolve the issues. You know, it would only cost Netflix, you know, a couple $100 million to make the writers whole here. And by the way, all of their top executives are making more than that in their annual fee, in their annual salary. And there was a letter that the Guild sent to the shareholders this past week, basically informing them and advocating for them not to approve their salaries until this is resolved. I sort of roll my eyes a little bit at that, because you can't really quantify what these negotiations are actually going to deliver in terms of a dollar amount, right?
You can't. You can say that we have created for our writers, or we've created for whoever the creators are going to be now, as the confluence of events are starting to come together, we've done better for you.
Wait, the studio argument.
Yeah, we have.
Or are you talking about the writer argument?
I'm talking about both sides. Okay. Here. We, the studio, has stepped up, and we are doing better for you. We've recognized the issues. We've come at it with practical solutions, not, oh, we're just closing the door and none of these arguments or anything that we care about. And on the other side, the writers have to say, you know what? Studio executives have always been paid a lot of money. They've been paid a lot of money when my pilot never got picked up. They were paid a lot of money when my pilot was never made.
Yeah.
And it's a false argument to me. It's a road that, well, you know, if you look at the CEOs in the United States and how much money they make.
I know. Well, media CEOs make more than the average.
You can make the argument, but, you know, I choose not to. I don't think that that's the place to go here.
Yeah.
I think the place to go is fairness. Look to the future. How do we make this generation of creatives feel that they can have real careers and really benefit from putting 5 years into something and not have the ROI on it be, oh, this is the least money I've ever made in my whole life.
The notion that the Writers Guild is going to somehow inform a shareholder of one of these companies that their executive is paid a lot of money, like, that's silly. They all know. Media CEOs have made a lot of money since the beginning of media.
As long as I've been at it.
But I actually think that the best argument for the writers is not necessarily the fairness argument, that because that's an altruistic argument, ultimately, that you should be doing right by us.
No, I don't think it's altruistic.
Okay.
I think you need to look at what we're doing in success.
Yeah, see, that's okay. The argument. This is better for everybody.
Yes.
The argument that when you train these writers, you ultimately get a better product, not today, but in 5 years when that writer creates a show.
Well, you're sustaining a business then in the long-term model. And you have to be I recognize that Wall Street does not look beyond the next quarter. But the fact is that is incredibly important to the future of the business. Co-executive producers need to know how to run a show. That is inures to the benefit of companies. The future of creative and the satisfaction that creators feel about the work that they're doing inures to the benefit of these corporations. So we have to understand that it's not a one-way street here. It is really important to cultivate and reward talent.
But you look at these stock prices, and these companies are all struggling at this point.
Nobody, other than
arguably Netflix, has figured out the streaming model. Why should they be bending over backwards to increase their costs.
It's not bending over backwards. It's the wrong way to look at it in my eyes. It has to be looked at in the long term. And I get that that's not the way the street looks at things.
But do you think the executives look at it that way?
Well, I think a lot of them do.
So why haven't they settled?
They're not ready to settle yet. I mean, come on. You've got directors.
Well, we're in month two of a strike.
You've got actors up next. This thing could go on for 5 months. This is, it is my hope that the directors settle. They usually do. In my lifetime, they always have. I don't know where the actors stand. And there's a desire on the part of the unions to make the companies feel the pain. And I get that. But in the end, the only solution here is for both sides to compromise. And that is the right thing to do.
Where do they compromise? I know it's speculative, but where do you think the pressure points for the studios are?
I think they have to take a look at how to sustain through a short order. I think.
What does that mean?
It means if you're only ordering 6 episodes, how can I make it easier for you to get your next gig? So it's not like all of a sudden they're going to turn around and make 22 episodes. We have to be realistic about that. It's not their model. But they were also being highly restrictive in the rules around it.
Right. Span protection.
Exactly. Yes. So I feel that that is an area to
let people get multiple jobs. Do not restrict them at all.
You have to.
That's kind of happening already.
It is happening a little bit, but you have to also remember that's hard for creators. Yeah. You know, you're in this over here and you have to concentrate over here and then you're getting a show that's a genre show and you're doing a comedy. And I mean, it's not that easy, but there has to be a lot more flexibility in that area. There has to be a lot more money in that area too.
Meaning paying writers more. If you're only going to order 6, you got to pay them double or something.
Well, I don't know if it's double, but it's certainly more than they're getting paid now.
Yeah.
And there needs to be an opportunity for the showrunner to be able to say, I need a bigger staff here. And by the way, we used to have the same issues in linear television way back when we would give the writer a budget and say, this is your budget, you know, use it as you will, but this is your budget. And you go, I can't staff for that budget. So there's nothing new about that. So there's a lot of issues here that are phrased differently, but they're similar issues.
What about this mandatory staffing thing? Do you think that goes anywhere with the studios?
No, I don't.
I don't either. I think that's the first thing to drop off.
You can't tell a company how to do that. That's just not practical. Look, you put it on the table, you ultimately walk away from that as an issue, that's okay. But I think there are other issues that really, really are much more important. And I get it. It looks good to the membership to say, hey, we've got a guarantee of 8 writers on a staff. Well, that's never happened.
Are you envious ever at the people in these jobs now? You know, it's been a little bit since you had them. The job is very different today.
It is
running
very
a movie
different.
Studio, a television network. I know someone asked me last night, who even runs NBC right now? Who even runs Fox? These jobs used to be the pinnacle of the business. And that, I think, plays a role here.
I think it's a good point, Matt. Ultimately, there needs to be someone responsible. Like, you need to go, I'm going to call so-and-so to get such-and-such done. A lot of the structures in the streaming market are these endless, as I describe them, these endless horizontal lines of executives. And there are 3 over here and there are 3 over there. And should I pitch to these 3 or should I pitch to this one of these 3? It's a confusing setup. It's confusing for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I imagine
you're like the ultimate insider. You know,
it's confusing. Yeah. My initial instinct is, oh, I'll call Bella, you know, but of course that's
Bella
not.
Bella is chief content officer now. Right, she has people working for her.
She's a, you know, Netflix, she doesn't need me calling her. I got to figure it out down here. And that's my job and my responsibility, but it's very difficult in structures that keep reorging. There's so many reorgs. I literally have to say to people on my staff, is that person still working there?
Yeah, I know.
And I don't like that. I feel badly about that. But it's a confusing situation. I do like to understand where the buck stops in any structure. It makes it easier for me as a producer to navigate.
All right, so last question, when does this end? I know I hate when people ask me. I still stick with my September prediction. Are you more optimistic or less optimistic than that?
Well, today I'm not so optimistic today because there's a lot of chatter today about the actors. And, you know, again, it's just chatter, all posturing. It's, you know, we don't know, but it certainly doesn't make me feel like, wow, this thing is just heading for real resolution quickly. But I do want to reinforce that this is a generation of people that deserve to be able to make a living as creators. We need it. And these companies need that to happen.
So do you think if the actors strike, that makes the strike overall go longer? Or do you think that puts such pressure on the studios that it gets them to the table? Because if the actors are on strike, everything shuts down.
Everything does shut down. I think for a while they're going to let everyone sit.
The studios will.
Yes.
And even the legacy studios that have these fall schedules that are going to be impacted.
Well, you know what? That's a great point, Matt. They have a lot of reality television. Believe me, I know all about, I know all about that play.
Yeah.
I feel like I was part of the creation of that play. And there are ways to sustain a fall season. Very true. There are ways to sustain a fall season. The advertisers don't like it. So there will be an end to this in sight, for sure. But the bigger question that you're asking now is, at what point do the interests of linear and cable television separate from the streaming services?
Right.
And that is real.
Yeah. Also, if the actors go on strike, we start to see the impact on next summer's movies. And that's a big deal coming out of COVID, where we're now seeing these movies that were pushed come out now. And if they have to delay movies for next summer, that's a big blow to the entire theatrical
industry. It is. And you know what? Nobody wants that. Nobody. Our business needs content. It needs happy creators. I know I sound like, hey, Gail, did you ever work in this business? But the fact is, we need to be able to show this generation of young people that they too can make a living at this.
All right. Well, Gail Berman, thanks very much for coming on the show. Appreciate
it. Thanks, Matt.
All right. We are back with the call sheet. Craig is also back. Welcome back, Craig. You had a nice week of brainwashing at Spotify headquarters in Sweden.
No brainwashing, Matt. How dare you? It was a lovely week in Sweden.
They got you. They definitely got you.
The power of music and podcasts is beautiful, Matt.
I'm sure you're changing the world for the better. Interestingly, You went to see the ABBA hologram show, not in Sweden, but in London. Give us your ranking on a scale of just pleasurable to euphoric.
If euphoric is a 10, I'm giving it a 9.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. So it's in London, and it's built a specific arena only for this ABBA hologram live show thing. And it was wonderful. They don't allow you to use your phone, which is great. So
great.
It just feels like, you know, it's kind of a recreation of a 1979 performance. It is as close to realistic as it can be before your brain actually just wouldn't work and not understand what's going on.
So it looks real.
There are moments where your brain is genuinely confused. It is so well done. The shadows, the depth of the people walking around on stage. If you squint, if you don't think about it for a second, you're like, that's ABBA on stage in 1979.
Wow. Amazing.
It's the future of concerts. It has to be. I don't know.
Yeah. There's going to be holograms for everyone. Rolling Stones, Tina Turner, all of them.
And the funny part is that it's not that ABBA's unable to perform. It's just that they don't want to.
Right. No, they're all live.
Yeah.
They just put out a new album. They just know that they can make more money this way and don't have to actually do anything. It's a great gig. All right. We are talking box office today. Spider-Man. Are you excited for the new Spider-Man animated movie?
Yeah. I didn't see the first one in theaters. I saw it at home and I loved it. And it seems like everybody loves these movies. They have a really high approval rating.
My kid was watching this at like 4 or 5 years old. He's super excited for this one. And I think like fanboys are into it. The reviews pretty good across the Spider-Verse is getting at what, 95%. And the tracking right now is about 85 for the weekend, which is, you know, much better than the original. It's like more than double the original. I'm going to take the over on this. I think it's got momentum. And I've seen a couple of early reports that suggest it could go as high as like 95, even 100. So I'm going to take the over on the 85 tracking for this.
Yeah, there's a freshness to these movies that feel differentiated from kind of traditional superhero movies. And it attracts people as old as your son and then all the way through adults. It's a really kind of a universal product.
Yeah. The Little Mermaid numbers are, in the U.S. at least, it's held pretty well this week. So it could take away some of that family audience. But I think it's enough of a different audience. Spider-Man skews a little bit more male. Little Mermaid is female. And I think they'll both be able to coexist this weekend. So I'll take the over. We'll see. I lost on the Little Mermaid last weekend because I picked the over on 120 and it came in just under that.
Right. It was like 117. I have a bone to pick with the Spider-Man titling. So this is called Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. Isn't the first one called Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse?
Yeah, the next one's called Spider-Man Beyond the Spider-Verse. It's like a 70s horror movie.
And then the other the live-action Spider-Mans are like, Spider-Man No Way Home, Spider-Man Far From Home, Spider-Man Come Back Home. Like, why are they all so
similar?
Because
they're meaningless.
I have no idea which one's
which. The original Spider-Man, the Sam Raimi movies, they were just called Spider-Man, Spider-Man 2, and Spider-Man 3. So, I guess.
I prefer that.
I mean, it doesn't matter. We all know what it is. It's Spider-Man 2, Spider-Man 3. This is Spider-Man 2. I mean, they just have to call it something. I mean, it doesn't tell you anything about the movie, but who cares? It's Spider-Man. You're going to go.
I guess. Use a different phrase that differentiates the movie from the first one. People are just going to Google Spider-Man animated movie.
That is
movie
a hot take that I guarantee you no studio executive will listen to. So congrats. All right. That's the show for today. I want to thank Gail Berman, my guest. I want to thank producer Craig Horbeck. I want to thank our editor, Jesse Lopez. And I want to thank you. We will see you next week.